Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, is made possible in part by the Department of State, Division of Historical Resources, and the State of Florida. It's also made possible by the Jesse Ball DuPont Fund and by the historic Rossiter House Museum and Gardens in O'Galley, celebrating pioneer history, the natural environment, and women's history. Available for weddings and events at rossiterhousemuseum.org. This is Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, on the web at myfloridahistory.org. I'm Ben Brotmarkle, and coming up on the program, Memories of Palatka, Florida.
So when she was a little girl, she used to walk along the riverfront with her mother, and she remembered seeing the river, and in any direction that she looked, there were boats coming and going, bringing people and cargo to Palatka. She said it looked like a highway.
We'll discuss the red snapper capital of Pensacola.
The fisheries of Florida's northern Gulf Coast were among the least studied aspects of the state's rich maritime heritage.
And we'll talk about the Ais exhibit at Field Manor on Merritt Island. All that ahead on Florida Frontiers.
I'm gonna lay down my sword and shield
down by the riverside. Oh. Down by the riverside.
Yeah.
Down by the riverside.
Palatka, Florida is about 60 miles south of Jacksonville, 45 miles east of Gainesville, and 29 miles southwest of St. Augustine. Palatka is the Putnam County seat, home of St. John's River State College and the Florida School of the Arts, headquarters of the St. John's Water Management District, and the site of Ravine Garden State Park. A quiet little town today, Palatka has a rich and colorful history. Larry Beaton is historian of the Putnam County Historical Society. He's a descendant of Robert Raymond Reed, the fourth territorial governor of Florida from 1819 to 1823. Reed's son moved to Palatka around 1850, where Larry Beaton's family has remained ever since. In the mid-1800s, steamboat traffic was very active on the St. John's River, and Beaton's grandmother shared her memories of it with him.
So when she was a little girl, she used to walk along the riverfront with her mother, and she remembered seeing the river, and in any direction that she looked, there were boats coming and going, bringing people and cargo to Palatka. She said it looked like a highway, that there were so many vessels that were coming and going. And one interesting side note, I'm not sure if I shared this with you before, but as they walked to the river, there was an ice house on Laurel Street, and she always cautioned my grandmother not to walk on that side of the street. And grandmother got brave enough to ask her why one day, and she said the alligators like to come out of the river in the summertime and reside underneath the ice house with all the cool water that was dripping, and it wasn't a safe place for a little child to walk.
A large mural on the side of a building in downtown Palatka depicts naturalist William Bartram visiting the area in 1774, where he documented the indigenous people living here.
It's a very detailed description where he talks about the small children playing in the water, and there was an orange grove, which he assumed might have been of Spanish origin, that was just a little on the north side, probably about the area where we are today. And from the village was about, we estimate, about where the First Presbyterian Church is on the riverfront now. But there was quite a number of people described. Don't recall the exact count, but it was a pretty good sized village. And actually, when this house was built, there were shell mounds that were in front that had been part of where that settlement was.
During Florida's British period, the city of Rollstown existed in what is now East Palatka from 1767 to 1783. Larry Beaton.
And that was one of the first historical markers that was placed in Putnam County, was the marker where the part of the settlement, primary part of the settlement of Rollstown was located. And it's a very interesting story. If anyone gets a chance to read the story of Rollstown, where he brought a lot of, I guess today we would call street people from London over to start this new settlement. And it actually extended quite a range down the river from here and also to the east towards St. Augustine.
The Putnam County Historical Museum in Palatka is housed in a building from the Second Seminole War.
It was built approximately 1838 and abandoned by the military around 1841. And as far as we know, I've been told this by several other historians in Florida, it's the only existing building from that period. It used to be across the street from the hotel and on the riverfront here, and we found out that that the hotel was acquiring the property and was going to demolish the building. So we, in conjunction with the city of Palatka, had the building moved to this site in 1985.
We spoke with Larry Beaton in the Bronson Mulholland House, an historic home in Palatka, open to the public.
Judge Bronson, when Robert Raymond Reed, my ancestor, was appointed territorial governor of Florida, Bronson was brought down from New York State to take Judge Reed's place as the federal district judge for this area. Bronson had been an attorney, and he had also served in the 25th Congress of the United States, and he served on a committee of the territories, and he was assigned the territory of Florida to study, so he became the expert in Congress about it. So he was a natural person for the president to select to come down here. So he moved to St. Augustine with his wife and also his two daughters. And he came here to Palatka because of the indebtedness of my ancestor and two other families that own what was referred to as the Palatka Tract. And in the process of doing that, he really fell in love with the community. He had already invested in a sawmill south of here, and he used some of the materials from that, but he was given 10 acres, or I guess he actually asked for 10 acres, on the north side of Palatka to build his home and to have a citrus grove because he liked it so much. And he eventually brought his wife over to show her the property. She was very pleased with the site also. So that's where they constructed the home. And 9 acres west of here was planted in citrus.
The Bronson Mulholland House was abandoned by the family during the Civil War. It was used by the Confederates as a lookout for Union gunboats on the St. John's River and later served as barracks for Union soldiers. Larry Beaton explains the impact of the Civil War on Palatka.
They assumed, because it was an important transportation center, that the town was probably going to be burned or at least shelled by Union ships. So most people in Palatka evacuated the town. There was less than 50 people that were left in the community during the war. And a lot of them ended up in Orange Springs in northern Marion County. If you go to the cemetery in Orange Springs, you'll find a lot of Palatka-related names. And another group of people took the railroad part of the trip to Sanderson, Florida, which is between McClenny and Jacksonville, kind of off the I-10 US 90 area, which was probably not a good place to evacuate to because that was just east of Olustee. And of course, the largest battle of the war taking place in that area. That's where my family ended up. And my great grandmother was born in a barn in Sanderson during the war.
A group of Black Civil War soldiers were buried and memorialized in Palatka.
There's a very old cemetery west of here called Westview Cemetery. It's off of State Road 20. It's kind of like a who's who of Palatka in that cemetery. There were originally three cemeteries. There was a public cemetery, a Black cemetery, and a Catholic cemetery. And the center one was the Black cemetery. I remember walking that cemetery as a little boy and seeing a lot of wooden grave markers, which are gone now, unfortunately. But a lot of them have been replaced by newer markers, identifying the fact that these were Black soldiers that served during the war.
After the Civil War, Palatka thrived with 7 large hotels serving tourists taking steamboats up the Ocklawaha to Silver Springs. By the 1880s, Palatka was a transportation hub thanks to the railroad, and the town had the second largest lumber mill in the world. In 1904, Mary McLeod Bethune started the school that would become Bethune-Cookman University in Daytona, but before that, she ran a school in Palatka. Larry Beaton.
She had met a Methodist minister in Georgia at a conference, and he introduced to her a minister that was here in Palatka that was looking for a teacher for their school. And so she ended up coming to Palatka and being a teacher of the school. She also did a lot of community work while she was here. She visited prisoners in both the county jail and the city jail and sang hymns to them, taught several of them how to read while they were in prison. And she did a lot of other community type work, very active in the churches here, not only her own church, but other churches. And unfortunately, that school building has been torn down, but we know the site and we know, you know, where she stayed while she was here, out off of St. John's Avenue. She had quite an impact on the community while she was here.
By the late 1800s and early 1900s, Palatka had entered a period of economic decline. A fire in 1884 destroyed most of the downtown area, and the Great Freeze of 1894-95 devastated the citrus industry. Some relief came in 1933 when Thomas Gillespie helped secure federal funding to establish Ravine Gardens as a tourist attraction.
He had gone around and talked to civic groups like Kiwanis and Rotary and some church groups and kind of sold the idea. And then the city embraced the idea, and he was put on a committee to go to Washington to talk to the Roosevelt administration about turning it into a WPA project. And he contacted a landscape architect in Jacksonville who was brought down to lay out the design. When they got funded, at one point they had between 200 and 250 workers each day working on the ravines. There was a nursery down, I believe, in Lake County that they ended up purchasing 100,000 azalea plants to plant in along with other plants. So that nursery did very well by the WPA also.
Ravine Gardens was originally owned by the city of Palatka, but is now a state park. Larry Beaton, a descendant of Florida's fourth territorial governor, Robert Raymond Reed, is historian for the Putnam County Historical Society.
I'm gonna lay down my heavy load
down by the riverside, gonna start.
This is Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society. I'm Ben Brotmarkle. Visit us anytime online at myfloridahistory.org to find out about upcoming events, watch our public television series Florida Frontiers, and much more. That's myfloridahistory.org. Joining us now is Connie Lester, Associate Professor of History at the University of Central Florida, Director of the Riches Digital Archiving Project, and Editor of the Florida Historical Quarterly. Connie, people associate Pensacola's history with the DeLuna Expedition, Andrew Jackson, and the military installations in the city, but it's seldom remembered as the Red Snapper Capital of the World, a self-proclaimed title that honored the commercial fishermen who sailed from the city on the Gulf.
Jason T. Raup, who was technical officer in the Department of Archaeology at Flinders University in Australia when he wrote a 2007 article for the Florida Historical Quarterly titled, Fish On, Pensacola's Red Snapper Fishery. As he noted, the fisheries of Florida's northern Gulf Coast were among the least studied aspects of the state's rich maritime heritage. But that wasn't the case in the period 1880 to 1930, when federal agencies and national magazines touted the economic potential for Pensacola's fishing industry. As Raup explains, his analysis of the Pensacola fisheries, quote, the rise of red snapper fishing intersected with national economic, technological, and social transformations that propelled the fishing industry into modern business and labor relations. As the technology expanded the range and length of fishing trips and ensured the freshness of deep sea catches, consumers from the nation's interior demanded access to the ocean's products. The resulting threats to established fisheries mimicked environmental and conservation concerns elsewhere. The presence of the Pensacola red snapper industry shaped the local economy and intersected with national trends in business, technological, labor, and trade relations. By the 1960s, a similar confluence of environmental, economic, and technological factors led to the decline of the red snapper industry. The Pensacola fisheries developed as the result of several factors. First, the superior anchorage in Pensacola Bay is unsurpassed in the Gulf. Second, deep water extends all the way to the shore, facilitating the loading and unloading of ships. Third, Pensacola is connected by rail to interior distribution networks. And finally, Dr. John Gorey's development of a process for producing ice cheaply revolutionized cold storage and enabled fishers to expand their range all the way to the Campeche Bank of the northern coast of the Yucatan. Initially, red snapper was fished by crews of pilot boats as they drifted offshore, waiting to be called into service. It wasn't long, however, before the commercial value of the fish as a tasty food source became known. The first commercial fishing for red snapper began in 1871, when S.C. Cobb and Major John C. Ruse established the Pensacola Ice Company. The proprietors contracted experienced New England deep water fishers who welcomed the opportunity to spend their winters fishing the warm waters of the Gulf. Their boats were equipped with live wells to store the fish until they reached shore, where they were iced and shipped out of Pensacola to distant markets inland. By the 1880s, ice boxes rather than live wells became standard on fishing craft in the Gulf. More efficient and cost-effective, the ice boxes allowed boats to stay at sea for longer periods of time and fish further afield. Known locally as smacks, these ships had sleek, deep hulls and employed a fore and aft rig design that provided faster speeds and easily covered greater distances. These schooners revolutionized the red snapper industry. Warren and Company dominated ice production, but they competed with at least a half dozen other ice companies. As Raup explains, ice house entrepreneurs utilized the integrated national transportation network that emerged in the late 19th century and systematized their business practices to maximize their profits and move fish effectively from the ocean to interior customers. The two principal fish companies maintained their own wharves for unloading the catches of their smacks. Saunders and Company owned the Palafox Wharf, and Warren Fish Company owned the Balin Wharf. By 1897, the Louisville and Nashville and the Pensacola and Atlantic connected the city to larger lines in Alabama that led to major cities from New York to Omaha. More was required than ice, new ships, and railroads to create a large demand for red snapper, and Raup outlines social, technological, and business changes that facilitated the sale of red snapper. The late 19th century recognition of the health benefits of eating red snapper and other fresh seafood was disseminated to an eager audience of readers through the use of low-cost print technology. Advertisements in nationally distributed magazines and newspapers alerted customers to the low-cost benefits of fish, promoting it as a health-giving food that stimulated and formed muscles and renewed the brain. The dinner plates of consumers were not the only market associated with red snapper fisheries. Fish meal plants used the discarded parts from red snapper and other fish processing to produce cooking sauces and animal feed. Ice houses also met the refrigeration needs of local merchants and townsmen.
Connie, historically extractive industries like fishing deplete the source of profits. Supplying red snapper for an enthusiastic market must have adversely affected the fishing sites off the shore of Pensacola.
By the 1880s, the decline in fish was already noticeable. In 1885, however, the U.S. Fish Commission research vessel Albatross discovered new red snapper grounds that ranged from Tampa to the Dry Tortugas. But the discovery of fishing grounds off islands in the Bay of Campeche initiated the greatest period of productivity. These fishing areas were 450 to 700 miles from Pensacola on the far side of the Gulf of Mexico. Successfully fishing these seemingly inexhaustible quantities of red snapper required larger smacks equipped for voyages of 2 to 4 weeks. A number of environmental, social, economic, labor, and international factors contributed to the decline of the red snapper industry. Fishing boat crews were known to be unreliable as workers and the source of social problems ashore. Periodic strikes by crewmen added to the uncertainty of the fishing industry. The Mexican government laid claim to the Campeche banks and sent the gunboat Vera Cruz to confiscate the fishing smacks Silas Stearns from Pensacola and D.L. Tafton from Mobile. Charging the crews with illegal fishing in Mexican waters, officials held the men until American diplomats secured their release. The large number of hurricanes that swirled through the Gulf in the period 1906 to 1926 and the effect of World Wars I and II further undermined the red snapper industry. Raup concludes, by the early 1960s, the red snapper industry that gained such fame for Pensacola had all but collapsed. Inventions such as the hand-cranked and mechanical reels, depth recorders, diesel engines, and radios might have helped the industry if introduced a few decades earlier. But increases in the number of vessels from Gulf ports in Mississippi and Alabama and further declines in red snapper populations brought an end to Pensacola dominance in red snapper fishing.
Connie, I remember eating many very enjoyable red snapper meals in the early 1980s, but they're much harder to find now. Thanks.
You're welcome.
Connie Lester is Associate Professor of History at the University of Central Florida, Director of the Riches Digital Archiving Project, and Editor of the Florida Historical Quarterly. This is Florida Frontiers. The Ais are the indigenous people of Merritt Island. Holly Baker has this look at a new Ais exhibit at Field Manor.
Corinne Braden is the director of Field Manor, the historic Merritt Island homestead where the Field family settled after arriving from Georgia. Located in Brevard County, Field Manor has been listed on the National Register of Historic Places since 1997. The Field Manor homestead is open to the public as a historic house museum.
The Field family came from Macon, Georgia in 1868, and that's really kind of the repopulation of Florida after the Spanish left. So, you know, we had been a territory. It took us about 20 years to become a state, and once we became a state, people started coming. So what brought the Field family from Macon, Georgia in 1868 was the start of a new life. So the patriarch of the family had fought in the Second Seminole War, and he was guaranteed 80 acres on Merritt Island. He had fought there. So they got to Merritt Island after about 3 months on the road, and the land had been sold. So thankfully, there was the 1862 Homestead Act that was started by President Lincoln, where you could homestead 160 acres, but there were stipulations. You had to live on the property for 5 years, build a permanent structure, and improve the property. So that's exactly what the Fields did. They homesteaded a total of three times. Between some family members for close to 500 acres on Merritt Island. The property went from the Indian River Lagoon to Sykes Creek.
Field Manor's historic homestead and surrounding groves tells the story of the Field family and their contributions to Florida agriculture and social history. Field Manor is also home to a new exhibit about the Ais tribe. The Ais were a Native American tribe who once inhabited eastern Florida from Cape Canaveral to the Indian River. The exhibit, Brevard's Native Past, An Ais Midden Along the Banana River Lagoon, will be part of a permanent exhibit.
So at Field Manor, we do focus on the early pioneer life in Florida, and that's our primary story, but we would be remiss if we didn't talk about Brevard County and Florida's native past. And so here in Brevard County, the Kingdom of Ais is what was recorded by the Spanish, and it's actually how we get the name of the Indian River Lagoon. So up until it became an American territory, it was referred to on maps in conversation El Rio de Ais, the River of the Ais. But of course, once it became part of the United States, it just turned into Indian River. But it's an homage, it's a recognition of the importance of the Indian River Lagoon in Florida for its early population. So recently, we have worked with a group, a local not-for-profit called Ais Village Trail, and they do public archaeology, which is just wonderful. Any of their digs, they invite the public to come out and work on it. However, they don't have a museum or a storefront, so to say. So we have taken over the exhibit. So very excited about the artifacts because it's contact. And although it was continuously inhabited for, 200 to 300 years, and the Ais were seasonal. unlike some of the other Native groups who were agriculturalists, these folks were still hunters and gatherers and remained so until they are no longer showing up in the historical record. So the artifacts that will be on exhibit do represent a time period between about 1500 and 1700. And not only are there the Ayes artifacts, there's also a number of European artifacts, which just goes into some of the narratives about the relationship with the Ayes and the Europeans. So we're very, very proud to have this exhibit. It's such an important part, I think, of Brevard County history, and probably because there are no descendants from that kingdom, the Ayes kingdom, it's really important to tell their story.
Field Manners exhibit includes artifacts and information on display to help visitors learn more about the Ayes, the first people to inhabit Merritt Island. Corinne Braden.
For the exhibit, of course, there's a lot of pottery. We have pottery that's traveled. Everybody has it's a St. John's kind of culture in this area, and they have the same type of pottery, same materials, the same motifs, same decor. But as you go throughout Florida, you can see that change in the different regions and the different peoples that are there. So we have some like Belglade pottery, which is not normally found in this area. We also have, it's very interesting to see how they would, folks would eat shellfish, but then they would also utilize the shells themselves, and they would have a second life, whether it was a plummet for a net, or maybe it was a hammer made out of a shell, or that became a hand hammer. So we have artifacts like that. And some things that are really interesting too are the European artifacts that are there. For instance, glass beads, lead splatter, which is usually found on shipwrecks, because you could do repairs or to keep worms out by sheathing your boat with the material. And there's also a ship spike. So we know from some historical records that the Ayes were really good at salvaging items from shipwrecks. So they weren't necessarily interested in gold or silver. They liked clothes for whatever reason. And they also enjoyed the metal. It just made their lives easier. Here in Florida, there was no metal working. And so if they could get a knife, if they could get a hatchet head, if they could get even a spike, you know, it just made their lives easier. What else do we have from that time period? Oh, also, we are full of middens. And so it's interesting when you can go through a midden and see the different shells, because that kind of shows seasonality and frequency. And I think that's really interesting. And even some of the smaller shells, like coquina shells or smaller clam shells, they would use as scrapers. And you could tell because they're polished from wear, from your hand. And you can also tell handedness, whether somebody was left-handed or right-handed, from some of these tools. And I think that's pretty neat, too.
To learn more about Field Manor and their new Ayes exhibit, go to fieldmanor.org. For Florida Frontiers, I'm Holly Baker, Public History Coordinator for the Florida Historical Society and Archivist at the Library of Florida History in Cocoa.
You've been listening to Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society. Please join us right here again next week. You can always find us online at myfloridahistory.org and on Facebook. Production assistance for Florida Frontiers comes from Connie Lester and Holly Baker. The program is edited by Giselle Concepcion. Have a great week. I'm Ben Brotmarkle. Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, is made possible in part by the Department of State Division of Historical Resources and the State of Florida. It's also made possible by the Jesse Ball DuPont Fund and by the historic Rossiter House Museum and Gardens in O'Galley, celebrating pioneer history, the natural environment, and women's history. Available for weddings and events at rossiterhousemuseum.org.